This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Thank you very much to the Chair of the Academic Senate, Professor Susan Cotron, to Dean Kelsey Martin, and to my colleagues at the faculty here for this great honor of the faculty lecture, where I would like to tell you about our work on the evolution of development from simple animals to humans via ancestral gene networks. I will divide my talk in three parts. First, I'll tell you about the cloning of the vertebrate Hox genes, which was alluded to. Second, I tell you how a gradient of cordon generates body form, mostly working in the frog. And finally, we will discuss how this work founded a new scientific discipline, which is called molecular evo-devo. And we work with the frog embryo, which has definite experimental advantages. This egg has been fertilized and is going to divide into two cells. And there is the sperm entry point. And then it's going to go on to four cells, and 8, and 16, and 32, just like when you were in your mother's tummy. And opposite to the sperm entry point, we have a lighter pigmentation. That's why this egg is so good. There is a rotation in the egg that determines that this lighter pigmentation, we can predict, is going to be the dorsal side, and the dark side is going to be the ventral side. So experimentally, is an enormous advantage. The cells here are talking to each other, just communicating at long distances, and as a result of that, from the bottom of the embryo, we're going to see cells moving into the inside of the embryo. Look at that one and that one. They're going to go inside the embryo. And the cells that go to the inside will become the ectoderm, no, the mesoderm and the endoderm. And the ones that stay outside will become the ectoderm, which are the three germ layers of the embryo. And at the end of all these movements, we end up with an embryo that has all the characteristics of the vertebrate body plan, and it has an anteroposterior head-to-tail axis and a dorso-ventral axis as well. And I will start by telling you a story about 1 year before I came to UCLA. And I was professor at the Biozentrum in Basel, Switzerland, and there we were with my great friend and colleague Walter Gehring. We made a very important discovery, which was the homeobox in vertebrates. Walter Gehring was studying homeotic genes in Drosophila. These are genes that transform one part of the body into a different one. And the first mutation was isolated down the road here at Caltech by Thomas Hunt Morgan, who found a mutation in a fly that gave you four wings instead of the normal two wings that the fly has. Another of these homeotic mutations is this one called antennapedia. That's the antenna of the fly, and in these mutants, a whole leg grows out instead of the antenna. So they transform one region of the body to another, and people thought this must be very important for the study of form and of evolution. And starting in 1946, Ed Lewis at Caltech took these bithorax mutants and started a genetic analysis of this gene and found it was not one gene, it was many genes and genetic elements that patterned the entire abdomen of the fly. For this discovery of what he called collinearity between the genes that pattern the abdomen in the DNA itself and in the body where they are expressed, there was no reason for that. For this discovery, Ed Lewis received the Nobel Prize for Medicine in 1995. So he predicted that these homeotic genes would be duplicated. And he thought there must be an ancestor like a centipede that will develop a gene and then repressed legs in the posterior, and then there'll be a duplication of another gene that will repress genes, more legs in other parts, until in the end you end up with three legs in the insects. So his prediction was that these homeotic genes would be duplicated. Now, in 1983, Walter Gehring and his group cloned the Antennapedia gene, this one. And so they decided to test the prediction whether these genes were indeed duplicated or not. And so they found a highly conserved sequence in this Antennapedia gene. And with that, they took that probe and they cloned from a library of Drosophila genes these other genes of the UBX, abdominal A, abdominal B, of the bithorax genes, as well as deformed and other genes. So you had this little segment of DNA, a probe, it's called, with which you could go and isolate other genes. These were times of great excitement, you can imagine. And so the first time we had common seminars, the first time that we saw this Antennapedia gene was expressed in the second thoracic segment in the nervous tissue. And so I got agitated and I said, no, this must be a peptide that is secreted to pattern the thorax of the fly. Because it was known that hydra and mammals at the time, they had a conserved peptide. Walter, then we discussed this further in his office, says, no, Eddie, it cannot be because Antennapedia is a non-cell autonomous mutation. And I didn't know what that meant, so I said, let's do it anyway. And so on the first try, we got this gene out of a frog, which is a vertebrate library. Now, these are bands of DNA, and they've been transferred to a strip of paper. And you see here, we got one band of DNA that hybridized with this gene Antennapedia, and also with this gene UBX at low stringency, and this one called FUTS. So this meant that we had a gene that had a common element with the fly ones, and that common element is a little DNA binding region, which fortunately has been extremely conserved in evolution. That happens only rarely and with few genes, but this was a fortunate coincidence that we could now take this and make this enormous leap from the fly to the vertebrate. So in the abstract of our paper, I wrote, a Senapus is our frog, Leves gene, was cloned on the basis of cross-homology to a region conserved between several Drosophila homeotic genes. And then boldly, I just added for emphasis, this gene could perhaps represent the first development-controlling gene identified in vertebrates. And it was. And it allowed us to do, you know, this huge leap from the Drosophila to the human. Everybody thought, and we all thought, well, a fly is going to develop very different from a vertebrate because, you know, what could be more different than these two? And yet, you know, we could jump this enormous evolutionary distance. It turned out that cloning these genes was very easy. So everybody and their mother started cloning these Hox genes. And through the work of others, not ours, people working mostly in the mouse and in the human, they found that the Hox genes, each one is a gene here, in the mouse or human, were in the same collinear order as had been described for Lewis in the fly. So this had enormous repercussions because you can imagine that during evolution, these two complex elements would never evolve twice at random. They had to come from a very primitive ancestor, and that takes us essentially to the beginning of animals, that the last ancestor that we have in common with a fly, we're all derived from the same source of life and have a common code, genetic code. So I like to show this slide because while we didn't do any of this collinearity, my student Guillermo Oliver here at the CHS spent 2 weeks making this diagram, which if you have a biology book, you will go and open a biology book, and this is going to come up. Or you go to museums, you know, the very first thing you see is this picture over there. Never with attribution. But it's true that it was done here at UCLA, at least for this review that we wrote. And the study of these genes has had for humans some medical implications. They're somewhere mutated. You have some diseases, malformations that occur. Some of them are overexpressed in leukemias. But the most important one is that they explain, I think, the most important from a medical point of view, that they explain why teratogens such as retinoic acid are so noxious. So the Hox gene complexes are turned on by retinoic acid. Retinoic acid is a drug, Accutane, used for the treatment of acne. So, you know, young women take it. So it's a complete disaster. And what happens is that these genes respond very strongly by being activated before their time and in the wrong place. So the most anterior Hox gene is expressed in the hindbrain. But when you get retinoic acid through the activation of these genes, you get malformations in the midbrain, which is all the oculomotor system, and you get malformations of the neural crest, such as a cleft palate. So it has helped us understand in the human some types of malformation. And it's not that this went completely unremarked. The famous, most famous evolutionist of the 20th century, I think, Stephen Jay Gould, wrote, "The discovery of homeoboxes allowed molecular geneticists to go fishing for vertebrate genes that might be related to the homeotics of Drosophila." Now, in science, I realize some of you are not in science, fishing expedition means that they're going to reject your grant. They say, this guy doesn't know what he's doing, it's another fishing expedition. But I am a fisherman. I'm completely dedicated to this. So, fisherman and a scientist. And so, for me, it's a great compliment. And he added, "Forget all the folk wisdom about the big ones that got away. This one has been one of the finest fishing expeditions in human history." Got to go with that, I think. And then, this sort of got me a lift. And we got an offer to come to Los Angeles, to UCLA, the next year, through the good offices of Liz Neufeld. It was her first recruitment. And we got to move right there from the first day into this house. And we've been there for 31 years. And I'm expecting I will leave it feet first. That's my wish. And so, how did that come to be? Well, there are many things that come into the recruitment of somebody to a university like this. So now I want to mention our dean, Sherman Melnikoff, and Dr. Norman Sprague, who donated the endowed chair with which I was recruited. Sherman died this July. Only he was dean, like Kelsey, for 25 years, built to this School of Medicine. And Dr. Norman Sprague, he had contributed an endowed chair, which is a fund, which will fund my research, giving me a certain amount of money every year to do foolish experiments that we would have never done otherwise or have gotten funded. So the two of them, they were quite tight. And so they took my wife and I to the Regency Club here. And I didn't even know that places like that existed. And they dined us and they wined us and they looked at us over, and then they thought, it's okay, although this guy studies signaling, it's okay for cancer, because that was... So he put this chair in the name of his father, Dr. Norman Sprague. And so I know that there are some donors in here. I can't see you, but I know that you have been invited by various deans. And I would say that donating an endowed chair, if you've got the money, is a great, great thing for the faculty. Allowed me to come here and sustained the research for a very long time. And I know that two of the grandchildren of Dr. Sprague are here, or I think they are. So thank you very much. And so here, our work took a different direction. We started the molecular analysis of an experiment, the most famous experiment in embryology, that had been done in 1924 by Hans Spemann and Hilde Mangold in Germany. And I will repeat it for you here. And so this is Spemann and his student Mangold. And you can take an embryo and just freehand. This is the dorsal lip, the region, or called the organizer now, in which we saw the cells go in. You remember that region of the embryo cells go in? And so what they did, they transplanted it into the ventral side of a host embryo. So this is, you get this little bit of tissue with a tungsten needle and freehand. You can just take this tissue and you put it on the hole in the host and you put just a little push and a push. And this thing heals almost miraculously. And 2 days later, you get an embryo that is a Siamese twin, like that. And the transplant gives rise only to the middle rod in the embryo, which is called the notochord, and it induces in the neighboring tissues the brain, the eye, and these muscles that are called the somites. And so that's like was the discovery of embryonic induction. And for this discovery, Spemann received the Nobel Prize in 1935. Hilde Mangold died before that. But we knew about this experiment, and we also knew since time immemorial that these Siamese twins occurs in humans too, but we needed a little push, which was a memoir of Victor Hamburger on his times as a graduate student in Spemann's lab. He wrote a tiny little book that was electrifying. And he was 88 years old when he wrote this book. So, it's never too late to influence science. So I gave one of our embryology clubs on Fridays. You know, we have this at the worst time of the week. And about Hans Spemann and the organizer. So this tells you, the important discoveries, they come through these seminars in which we exchange ideas and have a ferment of ideas. And like Kelsey has said, this has been my contribution to UCLA, 93 quarters in a row for students. So it's a course for students. And so that has been, together with colleagues, now I do it with Jeff Long, but with others over the years. And so what we did, then, cloning had become practical. So we took this little square of tissue that you saw in the movie, and we made cDNA libraries to clone the genes that are expressed in this region. Molecular biology is a great equalizer in biology. You could isolate genes. Anybody could do it. And of the many genes we isolated, two were very important. One is called cordon, and the other one, called noggin, was isolated at Berkeley by Richard Harlan. So I'm going to tell you about cordon, which is essential for this process of the organoid. So cordon is a protein that is secreted is produced in enormous amounts in that region that when transplanted has this Spemann organizer inductive activity. We found later that cordon is this long protein that binds to a growth factor called bone morphogenetic proteins. Bone morphogenetic proteins were discovered here at UCLA in the 60s by Dr. Marshall Urist, an orthopedic surgeon, who was trying to induce bone, and he did. So taking acid, hydrochloric acid, and cow bones, extracted these bone morphogenetic proteins. What he didn't know was that this would be crucial in embryonic development, but they make bone. And so we studied this, and the more that we started studying, we realized it's not just the dorsal part of the embryo that is important. There is on the opposite pole other proteins, such as this one called SISL, that have a complementary role. So the entire embryo is playing in this process. And over the years, then we isolated a network of biochemical proteins, all secreted, all bind to each other. So they're interacting extracellular proteins. And the key one is this one, cordon, that binds BMPs and takes them towards the ventral. And then we discovered that there is an enzyme called toloid, which cuts cordon. So it digests cordon, and then it can liberate BMP at the other end, and this sizzle is an inhibitor of the protease of cordon. So in a cartoon, it's something like this. You have cordon, it binds BMP, prevents it from binding to its receptor. Then toloid is indicated here by the little scissors. It will cut in two particular places that we identified, and then BMP, together with a cofactor, will be binding to its receptor and give a signal inside the cell. Sizzled? Oh, sorry. Shall I start again? No. Sizzled can also bind to the scissors, but it cannot be cut. So it's what we call a competitive enzymatic inhibitor, and therefore it's an inhibitor of this process. And now we know, throughout the years of study, that there is a gradient of activity of BMP, which is established by these antagonists of BMP that bind BMP, cordon and noggin, both are, and that this gradient determines the composition of the tissues of the embryo. So in the ectoderm, we have the central nervous system at low BMP levels. So that's what makes your brain and your spinal cord. It's low BMP. At high BMP, you will get epidermis, the skin. In the mesoderm, which are these two lines here, at low BMP, you're going to get first the notochord. Then, at higher BMP levels, you're going to get the somite with this muscle, then kidney, then lateral plate, and at the highest levels, blood islands. So this lateral plate is the mesoderm here. And so it is very important then, because this makes the tissues of the animal. And so what is then, how is this gradient generated? Are they three gradients, one for the ectoderm, one for the mesoderm, one for the endoderm? If so, how are they coordinated all into one whole? And we didn't know that until more recently, that given that cordon is such an abundant protein, we were able to show that cordon forms a gradient from the dorsal to the ventral side of the embryo. And this gradient is formed in a very thin line that you see is an extracellular matrix that separates the ectoderm from the mesoderm, or the ectoderm from the endoderm. And since this is a sphere, you have to imagine the gradient forms from this extracellular matrix all the way to this region here. But the RNA is made in a very localized fashion. This is the protein, but the messenger that makes the protein is very localized. So this protein has to be diffusing. And it's diffusing over very long distances. This is over 10,000 cells. And you see that now this very narrow region, we call it a signaling highway, in which this cordon must reach immensely concentrated amounts. This is a control protein that you see is uniform, fibronectin. And so this gradient, this from here to here, it has 2 millimeters. So it's a very long distance. And it's the first time that someone has observed this morphogenetic gradients in the extracellular space. And now we can see how, from a gradient, cells in the ectoderm can be sensing the amount of BMP and cordon, and cells in the mesoderm can also be sensing them on this direction. And in this region, cells in the endoderm and the ectoderm can also be sensing them. And so this explains how we can have a continuous gradient while the cells are moving. You saw those movements, they move, morphogenetic movements, and still they're sensing this as they move. So this is, you know, for us, it's an interesting thing because cells can move and still sense this ancient gradient. So you might ask, well, what happens when you do the Spemann experiment? You put this little bit of tissue, and now out of one, you get two. And so you would predict that there will be two gradients. And in fact, that's what you do get. This is an albino embryo. This is a graft labeled with GFP, green fluorescent protein. And you can see perhaps that there is a gradient diffusing from the graft into the host embryo. This is another case. You see a diffusion into the host embryo and in the other direction as well. So So then from one gradient you have two. This point proves the point that there is a long distance diffusion of this protein that we call a morphogen. And they're called morphogens because they determine form. And so it's not just the tissues that you make, it's also these gradients determining the form of the embryos. And people like Darcy Thompson had thought, well, how do in evolution we get changes? For example, this moonfish has very closely related fish that look like regular fish. So how do you go? You expand this region versus, you know, this region. So he said there must be like a system of coordinates that you can change by changing a coefficient and expand it or contract it. And you can take, for example, sizzled, and we can put something that inhibits sizzled, and just on the ventral side of the embryo, then the head is normal, and we can expand the tissues in the tail because sizzled inhibits the protease. So normally then you'll have more toloid, you'll have less cordon and more BMP. So that's how that works. And you can play these games, and you can also take toloid and knock down toloid. And then you get the opposite result. You get a much shorter tail, and there's even fish mutants that have this change in shape. And so now I would like to tell you about the property, one of the most fascinating properties of the embryo, which is the property of self-organization, which is what defines life, the embryo. It always tries to make an embryo as perfect as possible. And so if you take an embryo and you cut it along the dorsal-ventral region, the dorsal part will always try to make the best embryo it possibly can. So it adjusts its pattern. But if you cut the embryo from the dorsal to the ventral, you can get sometimes identical twins just by cutting this. So this to me is the ultimate regeneration, because you have half an embryo and you regenerate half the body. So that is really interesting, we think. But the problem is we couldn't study it because it's only a small percentage of embryos, maybe 1%, 2%, in which you're going to get these nice twins. So you can't study it. But what this needed was a new postdoc. So that's Yuki Moriyama, who's sitting here. And here you can see the great advantage of this egg. So I'm going to show you how we do experiments. Before, I just showed you cartoons. So we're going to show you how we do experiments. And you can see that a great advantage of having the dorsal side, if you would cut it along this thing, you would hope to get an embryo. And he can get it in upwards of 50%. So now we can study it. So first he has to remove the zona pellucida. And then the secret was to use his own eyelash. So take an eyelash knife, and you get much better results with the embryo. So what happens is now the embryo, this is the dorsal side that is going to heal rapidly, and it's going to come to oppose the most dark side, the high BMP. This is the lowest BMP, this is going to be the highest BMP. And this healing occurs very fast. In 1 hour, this is the period of 1 hour, you can see how the embryo is healing. And what happens is that the dorsal side, what was the most dorsal, comes to be next to the most dark ventral side. And I'm going to tell you the conclusion first. The conclusion is that the Spemann organizer, the cordon, instead of forming here, is not yet formed, so it's going to move 90 degrees and it's going to form in this region. And we can study this by studying what's called lineage tracing. So you can take embryos and put them color marks. So here is a 4-cell embryo. The two dorsal cells are marked and with red, and you can see that they give rise to the central nervous system, to the notochord, and a little bit of the dorsal endoderm. And they also give rise to a little bit of this medial somite. But the rest of the somite, of muscle, comes all from the ventral side. I must say that this media so much surprised us, but it shouldn't have surprised us, because then later studies showed that it's just part of this known, very well-known convergence movements that keep taking the cells to the midline of the embryo. In fact, this was known in the chick since 1970. But what happens now if you take the half embryo? So you do the same experiment, cut the embryo in half, and what you get is that the embryo, the midline still comes from the two dorsal cells, but on one side, the somite now is coming from the ventral side entirely. And what was very good about this is that this part is always more pigmented, and that was a puzzle for us, because whenever these are going to give a good twin, the one half is dark and the other one is much lighter. And this is the other part of this embryo. So it's dark and lighter. And when you have that, they're going to try to make the best twin. But the embryo normally is uniformly pigmented. This pigment comes all from the mother, right? So how did this arise? So to study that, I must tell you that the frog embryo is like an orange. So the orange has segments. And so the frog embryo has 1, 2, 3, 4 segments at early stages. And at 16-cell stage, you can label them with 4 injections. So you can label any of these segments of the embryo that you wish. And here, with an enzyme called beta-galactosidase, we have a mark of the segment 4. And then you can take that embryo and cut it in half. And then it will heal. And now you will have the segment 1, this one here, healing next to the segment 4. And what you see is that the pigmented epidermis always comes from, mostly comes from segment 4. And from segment 3, you get the unpigmented epidermis, the two halves. So what that reflects is that the organizer that would have been formed here now has moved by 90 degrees so that now it will divide the progeny of these two cells. We have many other types of experiments, but they're not pretty enough to show you yet. So they're under development as we speak. But so we undertook a big effort on RNA sequencing, because now you can look at the RNA-seq, you can look at 20,000 genes and their expression and so on, to see if we could find a magic regeneration gene. And the truth is we haven't, but just to show you the type of things, you take a dorsal half and you let it regenerate for 5 hours, or a ventral half regenerates. A lot of ventral half regenerate. A lot of genes go up, red, or go down in green, and so in these halves. But when we take these dorsal-ventral embryos, and these are 3 different experiments, there's no reproducible gene that goes up or that really goes down when you do this regeneration. So we don't have the magic bullet for regeneration, that's what we're seeking, but this is still ongoing. There's always hope. But it looks that right now that what is happening is that the organizer moves. It's in place of its induction, probably chased by high BMP levels from the dorsal to this middle region. Then it involutes and then has this inductive activity that normally the organizer has. So I thought I would show you how you do experiments. So that's really where we are today. But this pathway that I told you is composed of many genes in the frog with cordon and BMP4 is present in many other animals. And in Drosophila, it was found shortly after that this homologue of cordon is called short gastrulation. And it has the same structure, but there's also a homologue of BMP4 that is called DPP. And so the whole system of genes has been conserved but reversed. So the fly is inverted to respect to us. And so we very quickly, you know, when we had these results with colleagues, we took fly SOG and showed that it could make a frog organizer. We could take cordon into a fly and show that it would make ventral and neural structures in a fly. So the system was inverted. So that gave me another 15 minutes of fame, because this got us into one of the oldest discussions in biology, which was the historical Cuvier-Joffre debate that took place in the French Academy of Sciences in 1830, that is, long before Darwin. And Joffre said, there is one unity of plan in animals. And Cuvier said, no, the animals are very different, there are certain groupings, but you cannot say they're all different. And there was no evolution at the time. But Cuvier, in the most extreme point, said, well, you know, let's take a lobster and let's see if we take and dissect the lobster and now turn it upside down, the neural tube will be on the top and the gut will be in the middle and the heart will be on the bottom. So it's like a mammal, but inverted. And so for us, if we were to walk like that on four legs, we would be like the lobster with our spinal cord on the ventral and the heart on the more dorsal part. So this was ridiculed, of course, but it always was there because this interested people putting order in nature of the unity of plan. And so while Cuvier won the debate, the unity of plan, this had repercussions in Europe. The poet, German poet Goethe, who was an aficionado naturalist. In the old days, they were all scientists, were philosophers. They were it was one common thing. The philosophy and science, they were one thing. And so he wrote, the volcano has come to an eruption. Everything is in flames because of this unity of plan in the animals. And the famous novelist Balzac wrote, il n'y a qu'un animal, le créateur ne servit qu'à d'un seul et même patron pour tous les êtres organisés, which means there is but one animal. The creator has used just one and the same pattern for all the animals. And so, this was a very interesting thing and it made me very popular in France. I'm big in France, so I was at the time. But we now know that this system that I just described for you, that we worked out in the frog and others worked out in Drosophila, is present essentially in all bilateral animals. And for example, the sea urchin, the beetle, the fruit fly, the spider. The leech has lost cordon, but it has a very different kind of development, has another gene called gremlin. But in the last year, the most surprising thing is that there is a sea anemone, is a cnidarian, not even a bilateral animal, one of the most primitive animals, has an expression of cordon and of DPP, BMP, on the same region. And from there, they must diffuse and be cut by, they have toloid, it's cut by toloid, and then the DPP is liberated at the opposite pole of this, even a radial embryo, which in the beginning has some bilateral symmetry. So what cordon and DPP are, they are machines devoted to making gradients, to diffuse over the whole distance of the embryo, the whole as big as the embryo proper, and end up producing pattern at the opposite side. And so from the point of view evolution and development, now called Evo-Devo, it has great implications because the ancestor of all bilateral animals, the primeval bilateral animal, Urbilateria, used this system of cordon, toloid, and BMP to pattern the dorsoventral axis, and the Hox genes to pattern the anteroposterior pattern. The ancestor had at minimum seven pox genes in a row, like we discussed. So it was had a very complex toolkit. It had all the same toolkits that we humans now have. So there was this, you know, narrow point in evolution where, you know, we all are descended from this little creature in the bottom of the sea, and now all the invertebrates and the vertebrates are descended from it. And there are many other pathways that are needed to pattern embryos and to pattern cells. But, you know, evolution occurs by variation and then selection, by natural selection of the fittest. But these studies in the ancient toolkit of the genes in the animals tells us there must have been great evolutionary constraints. That means you cannot evolve just any animal. You have to evolve animals that are compatible with the use of this ancient toolkit. Nevertheless, you get all these, you know, enormous variety. But there is this little bottleneck that Kelsey Martin was alluding to, you know, at a certain time in development when you have to do that. Oh, I jumped too fast. But so let me tell you that this, evolutionary constraints. And so these things will bring you sometimes, you know, completely unjustified honors that are too big for these discoveries. Because these discoveries are injecting colors into frog eggs and cutting them up. But the greatest honor that it got me was to get into the Pontifical Academy of Sciences in 2010. And people ask me about this, so I'm going to tell you a little bit. This is a group of 80 scientists over the whole world and all the sciences. And we meet every 2 years. Sometimes there's special study weeks. And we're like the link of the church to the modern world or the science world. And it's a useful thing. In fact, it's the oldest academy in the world. And had another name before. It was called Academia dei Lince, Academy of the Lynxes. But now it has, that is now the Italian Academy, but it's continuous with this one. And it's for all creeds. I think most of the members are atheists. Then our president is a Protestant. We have three members that almost all the time fly directly from Israel to the meetings of our academy. But I am a Catholic, so for me it has extra bonus points. And so I talk to them about evolution. I give talks like this, and you have a cardinal walk in and sit in your lecture. It's mind-blowing that you can get to this, you know, level, and the discussions are really interesting. And it's the old school. You know, you've heard the expression to present a paper. Well, there you have to go with your paper and present it. And then you talk. And so they print it, and the other guys are reading what you say. So it's a old-fashioned kind of thing. And that another thing that comes with age that is a very good thing is that you can serve in various things that help science or promote science. And this is something that I greatly enjoyed. This is the Pew Trust has a program for Latin American fellows to come study in the United States. And then we give them a grant to start their own independent lab, which is very small, but in Latin America makes a huge difference. So I've been in this committee for 25 years. It's only 10 fellowships per year, but now we have over 200 labs in all of Latin America. So, and they're all networked, and we know who they are and where they are. And I'm also in the Council of the Latin American Academy of Sciences. So I pull all these strings, which is a very interesting, I think, activity once you get to be of a certain age. And so then this brings us to this beautiful place. And I would like to now reflect a little. So following the thread of my own scientific life, it would seem so unlikely that starting from a medical school far away and so long ago in Uruguay, why would one would end up in the faculty of a beautiful university such as this? And dedicated all my life to the exploration of the natural world through the prism of the genes that control development. I always found it amazing that the university system is designed for the rapid improvement of young students. I was 38 when I got this chair here. And it has always been so, for this is the very purpose of the modern university, which, as you know, started with the foundation of the University of Bologna in the 11th century. This was followed by the second university, which was the Sorbonne in Paris, through which I am linked through an honorary degree. And it is this same flow of history that continues in institutions such as ours. So now I will ask you to make a thought experiment. Imagine what LA would be without UCLA, delete UCLA. So I imagine you're thinking, you're saying, probably the internet would have been delayed, because as you know, the first email was sent from a basement in LA, UCLA, to Caltech. So that's the origin of the internet. Or you might think that the discovery of a new disease, AIDS, would have been delayed. Or that the discovery of the wiring mechanism of the brain would be delayed. Or that the miracle cancer drugs that have been developed here would have been postponed. Even further, imagine you delete the University of California. It's very likely that if the University of California had not existed, we would not have the biomedical revolution of recombinant DNA that has founded a new pharmaceutical industry. But I would like to argue that have generated enormous wealth for our state and our country. But I would argue that the most important thing is that without UCLA, California would be much poorer intellectually. Arts, languages, history, music, science, engineering would be less developed in this city by the sea. It is thanks to the thousands of young people that have passed through our doors that we enjoyed a cultivated and civilized society. This is to me the great contribution of the modern university: civilization. Thus, being part of the faculty of UCLA, training new generations of young people, is both a great honor and a noble endeavor. And I would like to thank the Frog Embryo, who has been so good to me, and my co-workers, and my present group, who are sitting there in the second line. Thank you for coming. And a long list of people that have trained with me here at UCLA, some of them very famous scientists. And I teach medical students. I teach embryology. So I must not leave without the take-home lessons, which are that the Hoxton cordyntoloid, these ancient gene networks, were used by all animals to create a huge variety of body forms during evolution by natural selection. That a self-organizing morphogen gradient in the extracellular matrix helps ensure that a perfect baby is formed generation after generation. That's one of the miracles of life. All mothers count, they have five fingers. How can something so complex be in our genes and developed every time? And so that's this early stages are benefit from their being simpler to study, and so that's why we can approach them. And then finally, what I think is another main point of this talk, is that faculty were privileged to be part of the civilizing effect of the modern university on humanity. So I would like to thank again the Academic Senate for this great honor, my colleagues, and to you for your attention. Thank you.
Any questions for Dr. De Robertis?
So you showed us that the morphogens establish a gradient in the embryo to direct the patterning. But you also show that when you cut the embryo into two halves with a different level of morphogen, they can reestablish this gradient. I wonder, there is a machinery that would degrade this this morphogen so that you can establish this, or just by simple generation and the diffusion would be sufficient?
Right. Well, the morphogen gradient, which I showed, depends of the source of cordon. And so what we have shown that the source of cordon will rotate by 90 degrees. We haven't yet done sections to show the morphogen gradients. Technically, it's a little bit difficult because you have to mark where the half embryo is. But essentially, the source, we know that the source has moved 90 degrees. But the important thing here is that you have this gradient and that the gradient is established by this constant degradation of cordon by an enzyme, a metalloprotease called toloid. So I don't know if that answers your question or no. Right, so we haven't done the experiment of staining the morphogen in the half embryo, but that's something that we can do,
Eddie, thanks for a great seminar. I must say I had wished I'd had that appreciation of where you were going with this when in the 1989 seminar on Spaman's organizer. But the insight into two gradients, I assume they're independent. And so the question I would have is, can you have one without the other? Is it in multicellularity?
So I think you're referring to the anteroposterior and the dorsoventral gradients.
Yes, indeed.
They seem to be quite independent. And certainly in Drosophila, they can work independently. John Merriam is one of our members of the Embryology Club who has been here since the beginning, so all these discussions. But in the frog, that's what comes from all our RNA sequences, always the dorsoventral that comes first, and it creates this gradient of cordon and BMP, the opposite gradient. But there are many ways of establishing that. So the previous step to that, in frogs, it's Wnt. In Drosophila, it's dorsal. It's another completely different gene, so that puts them together. So, basically, some animals have lost a lot of Hox genes, and they're all the Hox complexes that get all mixed up, like the sea urchins. So they lose their anteroposterior. So. They seem to be independent gradients, and the anteroposterior seems to be related with the late Wnt signal. So they do seem to be independent, but who knows in the ancestor. But in the frog, if you don't have any dorsoventral pattern, you don't get the anteroposterior, the Hox. There they're linked, but I think in many animals they're not. So, and then there's the left-right axis also, which is another ancient signaling mechanism.
I'm curious about the common ancestor with the seven Hox genes, the slide you showed very briefly. So if this is the ancestor to the bilateral, how do we explain the octopus having very similar eyes to the human eye?
Right, well, yeah, you're referring to this. And one idea is that this animal had an elongated blastopore, which could be an elongated mouth and anus. And then in the fly, you form the nervous system, well, not the fly, all the invertebrates, then this would get fused, and they're called a protostome, mouth first, and then this closes. So then in the vertebrate, you have deuterostome, means mouth second. So the anus is where the gastrulation takes place. So in one, the gastrulation takes place mostly through this end, through the other. And so one idea is that the ancestor had a gastrulation that could gastrulate all along the length of the embryo. And the inversion comes from how you close this region, the blastopore, along which the nervous system forms. So that's kind of what people think.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.